Hello and welcome to a special edition of Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker, GLT News Director.
And I'm reporter Mary Cullen. This is GLT Community Conversation on Youth Mental Health Issues is made possible with support from the Alice and Fannie Fell Trust at Illinois State University. Let's introduce our panelists for this evening's conversation. Diane Wolf is the Assistant Superintendent for Curriculum and Instruction at District 87 Schools in Bloomington. Stephanie Roberts is the mother of Isabel Molina, a young woman who took her own life. Tom Barr is the Executive Director of the McLean County Center for Human Services.
Tricia Mlott is the Supervisor of the McLean County Behavioral Health Coordinating Council. Dr. Mary Dobbins of SIU Medicine is board certified in three disciplines, adult, child, and adolescent psychiatry, and pediatrics. And Judge Brian Goldrick sits on the 11th Circuit bench. He currently handles juvenile court cases involving both neglect and abuse and delinquency.
Let's open the discussion by having Stephanie Roberts tell her daughter's story. Isabel's experience in trying to get help for her daughter, in fact, helped lead to this event tonight, as did other community moves to address mental health needs in McLean County.
I am here representing my daughter, Isabel. I'm here instead of her because a few months ago, she lost her battle with depression. I'm here today to be her voice and highlight what I witnessed, which is a big and scary flaw in our system. I watched her struggle for months, not being able to receive the help that she needed. I spent the last months with her, trying to do everything I could to get her into some doctor, any doctor, or even to have a doctor call us back. In Illinois, in 2017, more teenagers died of suicide than cancer. Yet if Isabel had cancer, she could see a number of doctors locally. We couldn't find a single one to help us less than an hour away. As I said, I'm here as Isabel's voice to do everything I can to make sure other families do not have to go through what we did.
Thank you, Stephanie. Let's have the rest of our guests talk about how they see youth mental health issues in their fields, whether challenges are increasing and whether the nature of the problems encountered is fundamentally different now than it was years ago. Judge Goldrick, let's start with you. And before you answer, I'd like the audience to understand that you are barred from talking about specific cases and rulings and should avoid any comment that can be used to infer how you might treat a case that comes before you. Within those constraints, though, please comment about youth problems, their severity, and how you see the courts interact with juveniles and how the legal system interacts with other agencies.
All right, thank you. As said, I preside over abuse, neglect, and delinquency cases. Delinquency is criminal court for juveniles, individuals under the age of 18. Individuals who will come before me, young men and young women, I will notice in dealing with them in court, they typically will be dealing with a host of issues, environmental issues, substance abuse issues, and sometimes those things tend to overshadow or cover up what may be some what we would characterize as mental health issues. I typically see individuals who deal with depression and anxiety. We attempt to provide services to them. Our court services office is very hands-on with the minors. They attempt to help meet the needs of those individuals. Typically those that come back to me on a repeated basis, we tend to struggle with providing them services. Sometimes, again, we can't figure out what the underlying problems are. You'll probably hear the term trauma-informed courtroom. That's what we are. We try to delve into what the issues are, try to get beneath the surface to find out what the problems are. And a lot of times, children, young individuals are not always willing to discuss those things, even in court, even in a closed courtroom. But it is a prevalent issue, and certainly in the abuse and neglect realm, we deal with those issues in just about every case, it seems, especially with parents. But certainly there are issues that are present for the children in our system in abuse and neglect court. But again, I think in that realm, there tend to be more services with the Department of Children and Family Services, maybe not enough, but certainly more than what we have available on a local level. I would say at least we have statewide resources, but again, there's still need for psychiatry service, psychiatric services for children.
Tom Barr of the Center for Human Services. You see a lot of adults that need mental health help. What about kids? What's the landscape like for youth mental health from your agency's perspective?
Youth mental health services and looking at behavioral health care from a problem area is in fact a serious problem. And I want to thank Ms. Roberts for serving as Isabel's voice as we're talking about this. In calendar year 2018, my agency served 720 youth, 18 or younger. As an organization, we served just over 3,200 unduplicated clients throughout the year, adults as well as youth. As one of the leading behavioral providers of youth services in our county, we have a value in terms of health services in the schools. We continue to place clinicians in the schools and currently have clinical staff in all or available to serve in all of the schools in McLean County. We continue to expand where services, where funding is available for that, and provide services to these youth year-round. We also have an on-site clinic program that serves youth at our agency at 108 West Market. We work to accommodate the work schedules with parents and are actively involved with mental health first aid. Part of the funding that we receive to help provide services in the school comes from the Board of Health. They have an embedded healthcare program that allows us to provide services working specifically in the schools to serve high-risk kids identified by children.
Diane Wolf, GLT has found in its coverage there are increasing numbers of kids in Unit 5 that are not emotionally well-regulated, complicating classroom management for teachers. Are you seeing that in District 87 as well, and what else?
Well, first I'd like to say that I think all the schools in McLean County, which we have 9 school districts, all are seeing an increase of students that are coming to us that are struggling. And they're struggling in a lot of different ways. And of course, because the school should be a safe place for them, this is one of the ways that we might see them act out some behaviors. But as professional educators, we know that many times those behaviors are the acting out of a need that is going untaken care of. So I would say that we've definitely seen an increase in the last several years. I think that's evident by us having this forum today, is that this is saying that as a community, we are ready to really tackle something that is in all of our schools, and it's in our homes that we are taking every student. And our private schools and our public schools are seeing that our families need help, and we need to be the community that steps up and says, we hear you.
You're listening to Sound Ideas in a GLT community conversation on youth mental health made possible by the Alice and Fanny Fell Trust at ISU. Dr. Mary Dobbins, what's going on with those kids Diane Wolf is talking about? And what's the landscape of child mental health? How is the landscape of child mental health changing?
The landscape is changing in many different ways because our culture is changing in our communities. And our communication styles are changing. I think part of the increase is definitely because it is more okay to tell stories and talk about things now, and I'm appreciative of sharing difficult stories. On the other hand, I think one of the biggest changes that sometimes we don't talk enough about is there's less resilience now as well. And I think of kids learning how to cope in healthy ways and regulate themselves and practice things in safe settings. And now kids are exposed to an awful lot awfully early. We are having explosion of information about how trauma changes things biologically, or in pediatrics we tend to call it toxic stress. It doesn't have to be a particular incident of abuse. But on the other hand, ongoing daily stresses cause similar changes. So we're talking about that more. There's more voice given to, with the Me Too movement, people are exposed to more. So I think things have gotten ahead of the youth, the families, the opioid epidemic. There are many things going on at the same time that are challenges to kind of helping children and their families be resilient when mental health issues come up.
Trish Malott, the Behavioral Health Coordinating Council is spending a lot of time and talent on adult mental health issues in McLean County. Give us your take on the landscape for youth. Yes, we are focusing a lot on adult services currently. However, we have also prioritized and continue to want to expand on the goals of the county's Mental Health Action Plan, and have been already formulating groups of collaborative community partners to work toward a plan that will address and create innovative strategies for youth and adolescents, and hope to have a plan for new programming by the summer so that it can be part of the next county board budget.
Thanks to the Allison Fannie Fell Trust at ISU for supporting this GLT community conversation on youth mental health in Central Illinois. This is Sound Ideas on 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We heard a little bit from Dr. Dobbins about why there's this increase because of a lack of resiliency or a decreasing amount of resiliency. Are there other factors at play that each of you see in driving the increase, and how much would you peg that increase at? We heard Tom say they serve 720 youth and 1,200, I believe, or so in all, probably more than that. But what do you see as the increase, and what's driving it in addition to what Dr. Dobbins said? Let's start with you, Tricia.
I agree with the increase, and there is some data that shows that rates of depression and anxiety have increased by nearly a third from 2005 to 2014. And I know even locally, some of our agencies that survey our youth in schools and collect that data have identified that there's an increase in self-reporting of symptoms of depression and anxiety and thoughts of suicide. And so I think the numbers about the increase are consistent across the board between national data and also what we're seeing locally. In terms of what's contributing to it, I think Dr. Dobbins explained it well in that there are a number of factors. I think our children are exposed to an increase in stressors early on. I think our family dynamics have changed. So if you think of what a typical family looks like today versus what it looked like 20 years ago, that family structure has changed. We also live in a society where there is an emphasis and a high priority on education and educational attainment, and there's a lot of value in that, but it also increases pressure on youth. So I think looking at it systemically and as entire units rather than just an individual, there are a lot of factors at play.
Judge Goldrick, would you enlarge on that last point, thinking of families as units rather than the specific child? What do you see?
Well, most of the youth that come before me, whether it's in the context of a delinquency case or an abuse neglect case, I hate to use the term broken homes, but the parents have underlying problems, whether those be substance abuse problems, their own mental health problems, and I think those things will have an impact upon the youth. Again, depression, anxiety, just generalized fears that they have, that youth may have. I don't think it takes any scientific evidence to support that there's a fear that people have that they won't be able to keep up with the Joneses, so to speak. I just think there is a lot of pressure on youth nowadays that may not have been present in times past. Parents wanting their children to succeed could be a host of different things, but there are, again, I think family makeup, family dynamics has an impact on some of the things that the youth deal with. And again, in my courtroom, typically it's families that have issues themselves, parents having issues, and that tumbles over or flows over into the youth as well.
Stephanie, did you see some of this writ small in Isabel's life, the lack of resiliency or things that overwhelmed or the ability to self-regulate that wasn't where it might have been a generation ago?
I saw a lot of needing to be something that she thought was perfect. Hair had to be done a certain way, clothes had to be bought this way. He mentioned keeping up with the Joneses. As far as broken homes, I mean, all Isabel knew was me and my husband, which is not her biological father, but he stepped in and took over that role. And I mean, we don't have any depression or anything in our house, so I don't quite know where Isabel stemmed from.
But the lack of resiliency that we've heard about here, is that perhaps laid out in what you saw as the precipitating incident that led her to start a path to depression? Would you feel comfortable sharing that?
I noticed around eighth grade some marks on Isabel, her inner thighs, where she was cutting herself. At the time, I just thought it's just not normal behavior, but something we can get under control. She went through a little rebel stage where we thought it would be best that she would go and live with her dad. About a couple months later, we found out that she had taken inappropriate pictures of herself and exchanged them with a boy. The boy sent her pictures on to other male students. So with that, I mean, that was her downfall. She went to school with a bottle of Tylenol in her system and told her friends goodbye. And luckily, one of her friends realized that this was odd behavior for Isabel and told the teachers, who called her in, and then the ambulance came and picked her up from school that day.
Thank you for sharing that. Diane, you had a thought there.
I think the hardest thing is that everybody's looking for one answer. If we could just pinpoint that it was this one thing, then we could take care of it. And what Ms. Roberts is talking about is a lot of parents' stories, that what she was just sharing is not unique. At what point does a parent stop and say, this might be it? And for all the parents in the room, we all know this feeling. Is this that one point? Is this? And that is the problem, is that our students, our youth, are being exposed to social media. I mean, I remember my mom and dad taking my princess phone and putting it away so that I couldn't be on the phone after 9 o'clock. But with a child having a cell phone in their hand, we all have them, and it's so much more accessibility. In the pictures, that is not unique, I'm sorry to say, that what happened to Isabel is not unique, that is what's happening to other students. We have let down the guard to say, show me your phone. Let me see what you're doing. And I think that every family has something, if you want to call it a broken family or, you know, a different family. I don't know a perfect family. I have never met one. All I know is that some people hide it better than others. But the fact of the matter is that our students are giving us some signs that as adults are new to us too. This isn't, we are in a society that we've never walked in before with 24/7 everything. And so I think it's a danger to start looking for one magic anything. Because as soon as you start doing that, the 99,000 other things get put to the side. So I just wanted to say that because I really am fearful that when we start talking about a topic like this, that we start trying to go down a very narrow road.
This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's Public Media. You're listening to Sound Ideas in a GLT community conversation on youth mental health. I'm Mary Cullen. Now, Dr. Mary Dobbins, is the increase in those seeking care, is this an actual increase in those with mental health struggles, or is this more of an increase in widespread acceptance of talking about these struggles?
I think that we're probably seeing both, that people talk about it more, it is more acceptable. I certainly see people coming in now that 10, 15 years ago probably would not have come in. On the other hand, the need is growing greatly. And I think especially I'm seeing, if you try to define mental health, it's being able to adapt to the demands you go through day to day and have a quality of life in that way. And I think what we're seeing as mental health referrals is very much what you're seeing in the school setting, that that's where kids are challenged and need to function. And so a lot of what is being seen as not being able to regulate themselves, which is probably part of toxic stress and trauma, things getting out of control pretty quickly because our systems couldn't adapt as quickly as the need was coming up. One thing to mention as well is clearly in the last 20, 25 years, we are seeing more children who are very mildly on the autism spectrum, and by that I mean what most people would call social communication disorder. And I see time after time, especially with the school consults I do, that here's somebody who's bright and the family's good and supportive and things like that, and they're just not doing well. So that is something that we know diagnostically we're seeing more of, that over 25 years ago, the rate was lower. We're identifying it now, and the rate tends to be going up. So there are some new things, but there are other reasons probably they're being picked up now.
Right, right. Now, Diane, we're talking about schools here. This seems like a perfect point for you to jump in. Now, the role of the school in the sense of how to protect these kids with mental health struggles, we know teachers, their role is already expanding outside of just teaching. They're becoming more and more like a counselor every day. So what's the school's role here?
Well, the number one purpose of schools is to educate students, and that's the whole child. That yes, we focus on the academic part, but we also want to have the social and emotional part of a child taken care of as well. So schools right now, I've been in education close to 30 years now, and which is hard to believe, but it's true. And I have seen that role of the teacher expand to the point that it's an impossible job on some days, because every single student brings in a different story. But it is our job to meet the students and the families as best as we can. And we're really lucky to partner with people like Tom's agency, the McLean County Health Department, had the Board of Health, have really worked to embed additional resources into our schools. So that helps, but it's simply just not enough.
If I may, that's where it's critically important for the providers to be providing services in the schools, because the teachers can help identify the children that may be at the greatest risk. And oftentimes, otherwise, children may go by unnoticed, even though they may be victimized or traumatized based upon different activities or things that have happened that have been beyond their control or the control of their families. And so being able to early identify those children who may be at risk and then provide those school-based services that also can be then provided in the family's homes with the parents, and getting the entire family involved in treatment, will assist in the overall higher functioning of the entire family and assist the schools and the children academically and emotionally.
Shamala, you just had a thought.
I do. And I think this goes beyond our community, but it also may be where we start to look bigger picture on a more policy-based level, where we start to evaluate what does teacher education look like? Are we equipping them with the skills to recognize these needs at any point in the education system? In addition to making sure that we have the behavioral health resources in our schools, but then also, you know, when we evaluate and recognize that physical education has a purpose and health education has a purpose, and art and music and all of those play a role in their integrated and relevant parts of our educational process, do we on a bigger scale need to look at having a mental health component as part of the educational curriculum? And I don't know that that's solved only within McLean County. That's probably bigger than that, but I think it's a start of where the conversation needs to be going because of so much that's happening in our schools.
Tom Barr, you talked about treating the whole family or addressing the entire family needs. Aren't there some real tough structural barriers, though? I mean, payment from federal funds goes to a specific individual. It doesn't go to family therapy.
There are a host of factors that will make providing community-based care tremendously difficult, and those factors are increasing over time based upon decreased funding on both the state and national level. That said, it's incumbent upon all of us to try to provide care at the best possible places, which typically are going to be in the schools and in the homes. And that's part of where, and at least in our community in particular, the county board and the city of Bloomington and the town of Normal need to be commended for the passage of the Behavioral Health Mental Health Action Plan, as well as the sales tax, with some of the funds designated specifically for mental health services, because our community is acknowledging that there needs to be more done, and we as a community are working more collaboratively to try to develop different ways to provide services in a host of different arenas, not just for youth, not just for crisis, not just for housing or psychiatric, but collaboratively for all of those critical areas. Because as Diane was saying, it's not one particular cause or one particular source. It is a combination of factors working together. And just as you have a combination of factors working together creating the problems, you need a combination of providers and professionals and community stakeholders working together to respond to those problems.
Well, we've heard from Judge Goldrick about youth services. We've heard from Tricia Malott about the Behavioral Health Coordinating Council. You and Diane have talked about school-centered or the schools being the hub for this. Would you rate the structures in place now and their effectiveness? Are we coordinated enough? How much better are we than we were 2 years ago? Let's start with you, Tricia.
I think generally speaking, we've made significant progress. I think there's been a lot of work to bring agencies together, to create collaboration, to get people on the same page, and to engage individuals and entities in dialogue.
And what do we still need to do?
Well, I think we need to continue the dialogue. I think we need to continue to discuss needs and areas for growth. I think we also need to collect data. So I think one of the best ways that we learn where the needs are is to collect data. And when we talk about youth and adolescents, we're really talking about how do we start to intervene earlier? How do we start to move toward a prevention effort? Because that's where we want to strive to be, is how can we reach a point where we don't have to have a conversation like this? And so if we can start collecting the data and sharing data amongst agencies, then we can start to evaluate those needs. We can start to evaluate who is at high risk, but then we can also start to use it for predictive analytics so that we can start to have a better sense of who is likely to head down that path to catch them before they even enter that point.
Dr. Dobbins, I saw a firm nod there. You had a thought?
I'd like to share my experience. I went into a new position where there was a very long waiting list for people to see me. And it became such a problem that the therapist started helping out. I assist primary care providers. So the therapist started helping primary care providers in different ways. And all at once after they did that, my clinics were empty. And so when I talked to them about why would that be, it is because they were engaging people, determining other, what we call social determinants of health, if somebody was homeless or if they needed food. There were all sorts of other things that could be done that weren't even necessarily mental health related, but a lot of other services or getting information from the school, pulling things together, and then all at once they didn't need psychiatry.
That'll increase resilience.
So that will increase resilience, and it gives people more of a wraparound everyday support. You were talking about prevention efforts and how we coordinate. So it's one thing of coordinating with services, traditional services and agencies that are already in place, but lo and behold, here was this new this complete type of care that was slipping through the cracks and was a huge need. So it's coordinating in a way that we help each other the best possible and don't duplicate or undermine or compete with each other's services, but then all at once you're also finding what's that in-between area that hasn't been developed yet, and I get excited because I think there's a lot of room for potential there.
Okay. Judge Goldrick, do you see potential for better coordination, or are we okay?
I think there's always room for improvement. McLean County, we have Criminal Justice Coordinating Council, Juvenile Justice Council, where key players in the community get together to discuss the issues that are present in the courtrooms. I'm not on the Criminal Justice Coordinating Council, but juvenile justice I am. And a lot of the discussion for juveniles centers around jobs, substance abuse issues. It's not to say that we don't address the mental health component, but certainly it's something that could probably become a topic that's more discussed.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker, and we're having a community conversation on youth mental health. Diane Wolf, how much better does the system need to get at referring, at communicating, at making sure kids like Isabel don't drop between the cracks?
We're all here, so the system gets better. I mean, I think that any kid that is having a hard time adjusting is and not resilient and having a tough time, and the families that do not have places to go is too many. We were talking about earlier, though, have we made any changes? And I want to address that because I think there are some very positive things going on in the community. 5 years ago, we started a Behavior Health in Schools committee that took people who did not know each other but were serving the same students and families and kind of mixed them up. And that was looking at, from the McLean County Health Department, the Regional Office of Education, and 30 providers to say, how can we get to know each other better to make referrals? And we really did and continue to do a good job of trying to coordinate what's going on in the schools and what's going on in our community and our providers. And we were able to come up with some really good prevention programs along with all the way around to the wraparound services. So I always think that there is additional work we can do, but I think we need to make sure that the things we are doing that are working even a little bit, that we make sure we continue to fund those. And funding is not just money. It's also in support. It's for agencies to take the time to work towards a common goal. It's school personnel saying, yes, I'll go to that meeting and we'll sit and talk about it. I think that we have to make sure that we don't get too far away of saying, what are we doing well? How can we make sure we continue to do those well so we don't lose any more services?
So we know McLean County has a lack of psychiatrists at all ages, and McLean County is not alone. About 50% of counties across the U.S. don't have a mental health physician. Now, Stephanie Roberts, I want you to talk a little bit about your experience in finding a psychiatrist in McLean County.
After Isabel's first stay at her first mental hospital, before we checked out, we had to have a psychiatrist and a psychologist in line appointments made. We had to get a referral from her pediatrician in order to get that psychiatrist referral. She went biweekly to her therapist, once a week to her psychiatrist. Every time she would visit another inpatient facility, they switched her meds. She had a new doctor put her on different meds, put her out to go to school the next day. She unfortunately had a psychiatrist who had health problems and had to close his practice. That's when we started calling anybody we could that would listen, saying these meds aren't working for her. She needs to get her medicine switched. She's depressed, more so than she normally is. They referred me back to her pediatrician, who would not prescribe her anything because of the unfamiliar territory of the meds. Put me on a referral list. When I called a couple weeks later, they've not even looked at Isabel's referral. They never called, so I'm assuming she's probably still on that wait list.
Now, Tom Barr with the Center for Human Services, I want to switch to you here. So we just defined there's clearly a lack of psychiatrists in McLean County. That's not a surprise to anybody on this panel. So can you talk a little bit about how to attract new psychiatrists to the county?
That's a challenge that the community's been talking about for years now. Nationally, there were a lack of psychiatrists. Psychiatric services and students going into medicine, psychiatry is one of the least popular of the disciplines for people to major in. And so consequently, what's happened is oftentimes many of the psychotropic medications have been prescribed by either primary care physicians and or pediatricians because of lack of other resources. But these physicians also recognize their own limitations and cannot prescribe beyond their scope of practice. And that's where new approaches, including telepsychiatry, has come into play. And I believe, particularly in communities where you can't find or you can't access or recruit and retain psychiatric staff, telepsychiatry is one way in which you can at least gain the assistance for the individuals needing that. Another example is through advanced practice nurses. In the state of Illinois, advanced practice nurses who have what's called a collaborative working agreement with a psychiatrist who specialize in psychiatric services can prescribe psychotropic medications to individuals. And there are disciplines for advanced practice nurses that include not only for adults, but also for youth and children. And so I don't think it's going to be a situation necessarily where we will be able to attract a large number of psychiatrists to our community. We've been trying to do that literally for decades now, and we're competing with the rest of the nation, regrettably, because of the lack of psychiatrists. And doctor, you can probably address this better than I. There are fewer and fewer people in psychiatry, and because of that, many communities, including ours, have had to look elsewhere to try to access the critical medication for youth in need. It's pivotal that we're serving these youth, because honestly, if they don't receive the services, the problems may very well continue. 50% of all lifetime cases of mental illness begin at the age of 14. And so if we want to have an impact not only on these youth and their families immediately, but also on the long-term impact of our society, we need to be addressing these issues as early as possible.
I agree with Tom, and I think it's important to note that there's a growing body of research about the effectiveness of telepsychiatry and telemedicine as a whole, and that the AMA, the APA, and the ATA, all American Medical Association, American Psychiatric Association, and the American Telemedicine Association, all cite multiple research points where telepsychiatry is just as effective or more effective than in person. And I think it's also important to recognize in the context of this conversation where we're talking about youth and adolescents that we are talking about a group of individuals who live with media. They communicate with a device. They FaceTime if they can't see a person, or they text. They are less likely to be in front of somebody else for their communication, that this is their means of communication. And I think it's important to remember that, especially in this context, but also that a lot of those social cues can still be picked up on video.
As effective or more effective? Why more effective? Because of the digital youth of today being accepting of it? But what makes it better to pick up cues and to assess a patient via screen than it does in person?
Well, some of it documents that people are actually more receptive and a little bit easier to disclose when the person is remote. If you think about whether you're more likely to have an intimate and very personal disclosing conversation with somebody that is right in front of you, or whether that is a little bit easier to do if they're more removed and distant, a lot of people are more comfortable when that person is actually not in the same room. And so a lot of the research that cites its effectiveness are not only looking at different outcome measures and different diagnoses and different ages, but also patient satisfaction. And so a number of patients are reporting, the majority of patients are reporting increased satisfaction with telepsychiatry.
I have read some of those studies as well. I've also worked a lot with telepsych. And for kids, younger kids, I don't like it as well, because so much of the evaluation is developmental. And that is very hard for me to feel like I can do a good job remotely. I think a lot for the older kids, especially if they're talking about people with anxiety, sometimes it is better even being remotely involved. Having said, I like working with people who have some skin in the game. And so you want to get somebody who has ownership that I need to make sure this patient gets better and I'm not just coming in temporarily in a new position with a company that does not know the area well. So there are pros and cons. It depends, like anything, people can do it well, people can do it poorly. Definitely, if you don't have anybody, and that's an option, of course you're going to do it, but I also find that there are a lot of things that can be done that don't always require a psychiatrist. I would estimate that maybe 10 to 20% of the work I do actually is what a psychiatrist needs to do. Most of the rest of what I do is what I would have been doing talking to somebody in pediatrics, but because I'm a psychiatrist, I have a long enough time to do it. So sometimes it requires expertise. Sometimes it requires looking at how we provide care to people in general.
Diane Wolf, so if the school is the hub for triaging these kids and saying, hey, we need to find XYZ service for them, do you foresee a day when schools are going to deliver telepsychiatry in school as a...
There are some schools, not in McLean County, that already do that. It is not something that we have talked about yet because it is new to our community. But I think Tricia is correct that we have a generation of students that do communicate digitally. And so I thought those were very good points for why that might be our next step.
Now, not everyone has a good experience with distance doctoring. Barbara Reinholtz of Charleston, Illinois, went to WGLT.org and wrote the following. Her brother is schizophrenic, manic depressive, and has been in and out of rehab. She asks, why is it some clients see psychologists, doctors face-to-face, and others on Skype? He says talking to a TV, as he calls it, is harder than talking person-to-person.
I can't address why that particular client is being served with telepsychiatry rather than seeing an actual psychiatrist. My guess is in many organizations, they will try to make the best fit. And unfortunately, that doesn't always happen based upon the resources they have available. But in this particular case, clearly, if the patient is feeling the telepsychiatry isn't working for him or her, hopefully a referral to an actual physician or an advanced practice nurse or some other face-to-face provider would be made available.
So there's still the shortage, though, nationwide shortage of psychiatrists. So telepsychiatry might help, but it seems like from Isabel's experience and Stephanie's experience that we've got more than any one or even two psychiatrists can do available in need just here in McLean County. Is it going to be profitable for different agencies, schools, the human service agencies, to bundle together and buy one or two and split their time? Or is that just going to pour little raindrops on a raging fire? How big is the need?
I think the need is very large. I also believe that it's going to be ongoing. And so it's not a situation earlier, Charlie, when you asked, are we there yet? I don't know that we'll ever be there yet. And the reason is, just as the problems that faced Isabel and many of the other people that we serve continue to grow and evolve, as these problems do, so do our response. When there is a lack of psychiatrists, telepsychiatry, advanced practice nurses, and other options become more available to try to assist with this. But I don't think that there will ever be clearly a situation where we will say, we have enough providers, we have enough psychiatric staff or access to psychiatric time necessarily in the community to serve everyone, particularly as problems continue to change and potentially grow over time.
Judge Goldrick, if I could get you to go a little bit into juvenile courts and how childhood mental health issues are persisting into adulthood and your experience observing that.
Certainly, in my years of practice and then my time on the bench, it's not uncommon for me to see individuals as youth, especially in the abuse neglect system, dealing with mental health issues who then become parents in the same system. If you don't address the problems when they're 12, 13, 14, a lot of times those problems will persist into adulthood. Again, I deal with a small segment of our population in abuse neglect court and in criminal court. So again, there are a host of other issues that surround the mental health issues, but it does occur. The younger we get children, the more apt we are to be able to solve those problems and not see them in the adult system. But it's unfortunate that we do see those in as youth in the system become parents in the system as well.
So as a follow-up to that, what are the social costs of untreated mental health problems? Tom Barr, Center for Human Services.
Sure. Some of the research that I've seen says 70% of the youth in state and local juvenile justice systems have a mental illness. And so trying to address that early on, particularly while they're in those systems, I believe is critical. And I believe, Judge, you're absolutely correct that oftentimes systems are pulled very thin and the resources aren't there. But because of that, as these youth grow, so do the problems that you were talking about earlier, and the individuals may continue to be involved in the criminal justice system at times where that path could have been prevented or changed earlier on during the course of either incarceration of some type by offering services to them not only while they were incarcerated, but also providing care on an outpatient basis as follow-up, because it's not a situation where it's a one and done. Once you receive medication or once you've seen a therapist, that you're no longer going to be involved in or needing treatments. Particularly for individuals that have very severe illnesses, they will need to continue to participate in therapy services, in case management services, in psychiatric services to change the path and move towards a greater course of recovery.
Dr. Mary Dobbins, you treat adults as well as children in psychiatric matters. Can you say what portion of your adult patients started having problems when they were kids? And what are the ongoing social costs that you see from childhood mental illness?
So I think you had mentioned earlier that most people that are going to develop mental illness have had some indication of not doing well when they're young. And so it's not surprising. I think one of the things that makes it difficult to speak about mental illness is that we lump an awful lot under that umbrella. So it's going to be different for somebody who has schizophrenia versus a developmental disorder versus trauma. But I am amazed that large percent of people who are referred to me as adults for many different reasons, the anxiety, depression that's resistant to treatment because they have personality disorders and are difficult to get along with, or substance abuse, and the unifying factor is virtually always trauma, childhood trauma. And many people who have lived through that don't even connect it. And I shouldn't be seeing somebody in their 50s or 60s who for the first time were figuring out they have post-traumatic stress disorder. If you wanted to have the biggest bang for the buck, you would be working on decreasing trauma. And related to social cost, we know that the kids who don't do well, they're not going to graduate from school, and with the education, they're not going to be in the workforce like they need to be, and then you get the cycle with the social disparities leading to more risk for trauma and problems.
That point leads us to a treatment question. Joe Strano of Bloomington asks the panel to address basic approaches to a treatment, big pharma, and what he views is the default mindset of doctors today, that chemical imbalances account for mental illness versus the childhood trauma default origin for mental health troubles. Discuss that framing, would you, and how treatment tendencies differ depending on how you view the source of the illness.
It is a profound difference, and one of the things that really got me into this field was learning about trauma and toxic stress. Clearly, the things we experience become encoded biologically. It changes how our adrenaline works and how our brains work, and when that's happening in children, the effect is even greater. So if I have somebody who comes in and I can tell that it's post-traumatic stress disorder, I'm looking at a more complex way and a different way to even get into treatment with them. There are more non-medical things or medication things that I would do as well. If I have somebody who's having problems because they have an undiagnosed problem with this social communication deficit or a developmental problem, then the medication management actually becomes much more simple, but then the social support and coaching becomes a bigger piece of it. So having an accurate diagnosis is profoundly important. And we miss a lot developmentally. And quite frankly, not everybody is coming in the first time they meet you and going to tell you about things they've been through. It's a process to make diagnoses over time.
Tricia.
Well, I think Dr. Dobbins brings up a good point that I don't know that it's one approach or another or only one perspective or another. It's really about looking at each individual and their individual presenting symptoms, their individual diagnosis, and also age level, developmental level, and how they respond. So I think it's important to recognize that each person is going to need a different treatment approach and that it's not only medication, it's not only one therapeutic approach, it's not only trauma. It's specific to the person.
Okay, childhood development. That brings up the issue of treatment and how development complicates treatment. Do you know, can you get a good diagnosis depending on the age of the kid? Dr. Dobbins, let's give you a first shot at that, and Tom, you're probably going to want that as well.
It's much easier to see an adult that you can more accurately diagnose and trace backwards, oh, this was beginning back then. With kids, it is emerging over time, and kids are more limited in how they can explain to us what's going on compared to adults. So a lot of our diagnosis ends up being dependent on what we observe, and we interpret what we observe. So I find a lot of times people will be giving diagnoses based on, oh, this is oppositional defiant disorder or intermittent explosive disorder or developmental dysregulation disorder because we don't know where it's coming from. I personally don't like any of those because most of the time, if you understand development, you can look at what keeps them from adapting and what's getting in their way. Is it sensory? Is it communication or something else? So children are a real challenge. On the other hand, it's a real opportunity to understand things in a different way than we do with adults as well.
Diane Wolf, you're probably going to want to weigh in on this too because teachers our childhood development trench warriors. They see it all and see kids go forward and backwards in as development happens and then regresses sometimes. How complicated does that make what they're seeing and deciding, who do I refer this kid to?
Well, I think it's really important to remember that teachers are not trained professional psychiatrists or medical doctors. They have been trained in the pedagogy of what they are teaching and their content. And yes, they've taken one or two child development classes. So that's why it's important that we're in a larger system than just an individual teacher making a diagnosis on an observation. And that's when we really need to depend on the parents, the families, the grandma that babysits afterwards, to start bringing a whole picture of a child to the table so that then we can start looking at, is a reading difficulty a communication issue, or is it something that's going on at home that's giving that communication, that child a lack of language to be able to express themselves? But I think it's really important that nobody is in isolation.
I mean, that's one of the importance of providing services in the schools, so that the clinician who may be doing the diagnosis or the doctor who may be doing the diagnosis can talk with school personnel, can see the youth in their homes, can meet with the family members and talk with them about what's going on outside of the school situation, rather than simply bringing the youth into an office and trying to make a diagnosis based upon how the child is acting at a particular point in time in that office.
So then how are we educating our young people about mental health and suicide? Diane, that would probably be best for you.
All schools have a social-emotional learning curriculum. It is seen differently. In schools, in District 87, our teachers, our counselors, we have social workers and psychologists in all of our schools, pre-K 12, and we will work with our students in an age-appropriate social-emotional learning. We also partner with community agencies to bring in guest speakers about suicide, about the signs of alcohol and drug abuse. Of course, the state of Illinois mandates health curriculum in elementary school, junior high, and high school that also has a wide range of topics. In saying all of that, we still need more. And that's when the communication in the home, that's when We know that students that are involved in school or extracurricular activities and have adults, caring adults, outside of the school environment or their home environment, having those conversations, that just adds that base to a child's life of people that can talk to them about emotions, about the consequences of emotions that don't fit in a social setting, but also give them resources. And it's really important that a community knows who in our community can you go to that, the saying is no closed door. Is that correct? That wherever you go in McLean County, if they aren't the right provider for you, do they know where to go next? And that's been something that we've all been, all of us up here have been working on to make sure that we know about each other's agencies, just so that we can help the kid and the parent and the family that needs that extra community help.
Our community has also addressed and really embraced mental health first aid and mental health first aid for youth, which are programs designed for the parents or for adults, the layperson, to help them understand the signs and symptoms of mental health issues and problems and assist them. Because oftentimes when someone's seeking help, the first person they're going to talk to is not going to be necessarily their physician or their school personnel or their doctor. They're going to be talking to their neighbor or someone that goes to their church or their synagogue or somebody that they have contact with regularly. And so the better we can inform the general public in terms of signs and symptoms to look for, not only for adults but also for youth, the better those referrals can occur.
Let's go down the line and have you all identify one or two top priority things that could be done or improved to make cases like Isabel Molina's far more rare. Stephanie, we'll start with you.
Definitely more psychiatrists for these children. And then there's gotta be a better way to red flag the students that need it. My daughter was in and out of inpatient care 4 times in less than a year when she was referred back to her pediatrician, who then referred us to somebody else. And she was put on a wait list. She shouldn't have been put on a wait list. She should have been red flagged. She should have been helped right away.
Judge Goldrick.
Difficult for me to say, again, because of the population of individuals that I deal with, but certainly more collaboration and communication is necessary. Again, as Diane said, they're trained to be teachers. I'm trained to be a judge. I'm not trained to be a psychologist, a psychiatrist, but we are getting education through our continuing legal education to become more trauma-informed.
Tom Barr of the Center for Human Services.
Without a doubt, greater access to psychiatric services for youth, for children, and for adults.
Diane Wolf.
Took my answer as well. My number one was more psychiatrists in our community. But my second one is to remove the stigma that we really do need to work together, that when somebody says, I need help, the answer is, okay, I'll help you.
Diane Wolf represents District 87. Dr. Mary Dobbins of SIU Medicine, what do you think the system needs to really get better?
I would use psychiatrists in different ways. I would use them in less traditional roles and use them as a consultant to the top of their expertise to help guide some of the other endeavors. And I would always return to that the kids and reflect family health. Family health reflects society health. And so much of this was perpetuated by health disparities, and the collaborative care that we so sorely need is paid for by Medicaid in other states, but not in Illinois. So I think we need to look at the mental health as a part of bigger things that can be addressed in other ways than hiring more psychiatrists as well.
And Tricia Malott, the supervisor of McLean County's Behavioral Health Coordinating Council.
Continuing to increase communication and collaboration between partners to work toward a combined effort. I certainly agree that we have a need for more psychiatrists in our community. I don't think there's anyone in this room, let alone on this panel, who disagrees with that. I think one of the other things is helping ensure that individuals know where to go for help and know what the community resources are. And in some ways, that's a little bit easier of a problem to solve. But I think that's one of them, is that so often we have individuals who think that their insurance won't cover something, or they don't know who provides what service in town. And so often they wait, and not intentionally, but the need arises in a crisis, and that changes what the need is and also when they can access it. And so I think ensuring we have access to help is important too.
This has been a community conversation on youth mental health. Thank you all. I'm Charlie Schlenker with GLT's Mary Cullen. This is Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal, a service of Illinois State University School of Communication.